Welcome to The Cost of Culture. This is a podcast for anyone curious about the hidden world behind the glamour of book collecting, and for anyone wanting to know a little more about history and about the Middle Ages. I'm Elizabeth Dernley, and I'll be your host as we look at a different aspect of book collecting each episode with researchers from the Cultivate Manuscripts Project at the University of London. Join us as we explore how a small group of people working in the rare books trade in the early 20th century affected the way we think about the value of European culture today. In today's episode, we'll be exploring the evidence available for reconstructing the history of the manuscript trade in the early 20th century and the activities of some of the biggest collectors. I'll be speaking today with two members of the Cultivate Manuscripts team, Dr. Laura Cleaver, the leader of the project, who you met in the first episode and whose work focuses on the manuscript trade in Britain, and Dr. Daniel Magnusson, whose work explores the situation in North America. Laura, in the first episode, you introduced us to the range of influential manuscript collectors in this period, from people like the artist and activist William Morris to Charles Dyson Perrins, the Worcestershire source heir. Danielle, you've been working with some of the biggest American collectors, so what surprised you most?
When I first started doing this kind of research, I kept thinking, probably because I'm a literary historian, that collectors purchased books mostly for the text. Hand me a book and I focus on the content. Hand a collector a book, and they could be looking for very different things. For collectors, books contain all these hidden values, things that make some books exceptionally expensive and others less so. They can essentially decode a book in a way that most others can't. This explains why, for example, collectors sometimes spent huge amounts of money on books they never read or maybe couldn't read at all. Maybe it was in a language they didn't know or written in a script they couldn't read. This is because collectors don't necessarily have to read a book to appreciate it. And one thing that collectors value quite a lot is provenance, who owned their book in the past. Collectors often want books that famous collectors have previously owned. And there's a surprisingly long list of famous book collectors to choose from, because book collecting is not at all a modern invention. In fact, American collectors in the early 20th century spent a lot of time looking backwards at the collectors who came before them, especially to a small group of 19th century English collectors.
Laura, why is it that some collectors are better known than others?
I think we can apply two factors when we're thinking about this. We have collectors whose names are well known today but are mainly known for reasons that have nothing to do with book collecting. So if people have heard of William Morris today, they may know him as a great artist or poet or socialist. They probably don't think about him as somebody who had a great collection of books and manuscripts. And likewise, if people have heard of Perrins, it might be in connection with Worcestershire source, but it's probably not as having a library. And similarly, if we think about America, JP Morgan is still better known in connection with a bank than he is for his library. But the big difference between somebody like Morgan and somebody like Morris is that Morgan and many others of his generation of American collectors founded museums and libraries that had their names on it. So we have the Morgan Library in New York, the Walters Art Museum in Baltimore that includes manuscripts and other things, the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum in Boston, and the Huntington Museum and Library in California, just to give you some names. So the actions of these very rich collectors, which included both sometimes founding museums and publishing catalogues of their collections with their names attached to them, played a really big role in cementing the idea of their importance in modern culture and scholarship. Lots of people had owned those books before them, but they now are known by the names of those collectors. In contrast, we had other collectors who just sold their collections or didn't publish catalogues and whose names have been completely forgotten. And there are lots of factors that play into that as well, to do with how well known they were at the time. But their own actions did play a big part in that.
So who else is missing from this history?
If we step even further back and we think about how collections are formed, I'm really interested in the people who have been completely forgotten in the picture, which includes the people who traded in the manuscripts, the dealers, both in the auction houses and in rare book companies, and people like librarians and curators and those working in museums who did a lot of labour, sometimes paid and sometimes voluntary, that helped collectors to decide what they wanted and what they didn't want, and helped shape the collections that we have today.
So what evidence do we have for this trade in medieval manuscripts in the early 20th century? What sort of things are you drawing on in your research?
The big collections, as I suggested earlier, often come with catalogues, which are a great starting point for understanding what somebody bought, and often have information in them about when they bought it. So that's a great place for us to start. But we want to go beyond the rhetoric that we find in some of those collection catalogues, but in a lot of contemporary documentation as well. So the other major source for these early collectors is often biographies written by people connected with them, typically after they've died, which are very positive, flattering, and present them in great terms as having done wonderful things. But what we want to do in this project is dig below that surface and test the claims that we find in these high-profile catalogues and biographies against what we can find in unpublished records, often in dealers' archives that record what actually was bought and sold and the prices paid for them, and by looking at a lot of the dealers' catalogues to compare what dealers said about these books with what collectors then said about them, and the extent to which there's often overlap between those two things shows us that actually collectors were sometimes heavily influenced by the dealers.
So who are these main dealers that we're talking about?
The late 19th and early 20th centuries saw a real boom in this trade in medieval manuscripts and the start of a real growth in North America in book dealing. So you had people emerging who specialised increasingly in rare books, and that included a growing number of manuscripts. And these are people like George D. Smith, who was born in New York in 1870 and spent most of his career there building up a business. He wasn't alone in that, but he became one of the most famous, partly because he was very good at publicising his activities. And another important American dealer of this period is Abraham Rosenbach from Philadelphia, who then set up a New York office as well. In Britain, you had a longer established trade, and some of those names will be familiar because the firms are still trading. So Bernard Quaritch Limited, founded by Bernard Quaritch, who came from Prussia, what is now Germany, to London in the 19th century and founded his firm, which was then left to his son and then carried on by other people after the son's death in 1913 and is still going today under that name. Maggs Brothers, again founded in the 19th century and still going, still run by the family in that case. And a whole host of smaller dealers that are now less well known, haven't necessarily survived.
Would you say that the hierarchy in dealers' reputations?
Absolutely. Both in reputations and really in practicalities. So people like Quaritch and Maggs and Rosenbach and Smith were, again, the big names, the famous ones who built up their businesses and liked to set record-breaking prices for things and to be known for trading at the top of the market. But there was a deep market. There were a lot of manuscripts on the market at this period. So there were lots of dealers who were handling smaller numbers of manuscripts for much lower prices. People like Bertram de Bel, who some people may have come across as a poet of the period, and James Tregaskis with his wife Mary Lee Tregaskis as well, who had more modest businesses but were still turning over fairly large numbers of books and manuscripts.
So why is it important to write this different history of the manuscript trade?
For me, the history of the manuscript trade looks like a lot of very traditional histories in that it has been written primarily as a history of great men, which tends to mean great, rich, white men. And it presents them as heroic figures, more or less in isolation. And that is really only a fraction of a much bigger and, to me, much more interesting story. So by focusing on all the other people involved, all the other bits of the network that moved books around, we start to get an insight into the contributions of women, both well-known women like Belda Costa Green, who became Morgan's librarian, and much less well-known women like Mary Tregaskis, who actually passed her firm on to James Tregaskis, who was her second husband. And on to people from very different backgrounds who often made quite profound contributions to the study of manuscripts, whether that was as an assistant keeper of manuscripts at the British Museum, who just happened to be in a position to advise somebody very rich, or as somebody who was writing catalogues for these dealers and in many cases putting down everything that was known about that book into words and into a published form, sometimes for the first time.
Yeah, absolutely. And we'll look at some of the women in the manuscript trade in more detail at a later point. So, Danielle, the focus of the project is on the early 20th century, but why is the 19th century so important in the history of book collecting?
So within the history of book collecting, the 19th century is often responsible for a lot of the collecting trends we see in the early 20th century. Some have argued that the 19th century is when we see a permanent change in the cultural status of rare books. And this can be attributed to a heightened awareness that heritage has a market value. This period is also when we see the term bibliomania appearing frequently, and it refers to a kind of perceived madness for book collecting. In England, where we see this term used early on, rare book collecting was a growing trend seen primarily amongst members of the upper classes. If you were wealthy and intellectual, there was a good chance you collected rare books or knew someone who did, or at the very least had an opinion about it, because book collecting could actually be a somewhat divisive topic. We see many famous private libraries being formed during this century, and this took place alongside a national rise in what has been described as heritage consciousness. So some members of the public looked at these private rare book libraries and thought they were wonderful. These collectors were literally saving the past and preserving it. Others worried that these collectors collected for the wrong reasons, that these libraries were really about an outward show of learning and cultivation. In fact, we see this debate still happening in 20th century America, but we also see American collectors who are eager to buy from these well-known 19th century English libraries. And you can understand the appeal. Collecting from these famous aristocratic libraries allows you to associate yourself with the English aristocracy. Some American collectors must have felt that they were not just buying books, they were buying an image. However, this new image sometimes involved removing national treasures from the nations that produced them. So if there was controversy about book buying in the 19th century, there was definitely controversy in the 20th. In fact, in quite a few early 20th century American novels, we find examples of collectors being mocked and criticized, where businessmen collect art in the hope of being taken seriously by others, or being taken more seriously by others, I should say.
So how did they defend dispossessing European nations of, quote unquote, their books?
Many American collectors defended themselves by arguing that they were rescuing books from places where they were not being fully cared for. This argument appears again and again throughout the history of book collecting. And book collecting has a very long history. There was collecting in ancient Greece, in ancient Rome, and in the Middle Ages, and up to the present day. Of course, there have been occasions where collectors really were able to rescue and preserve books from neglect and destruction. Historically, there have been numerous periods of concentrated book loss. During the 16th century, for example, the dissolution of the monasteries in England suddenly made a large number of medieval manuscripts available. Antiquarians at the time were legitimately concerned that priceless books were going to be lost forever, and they had good reason to be concerned. Quite a lot of books were lost, and there were stories, for example, of people using leaves from medieval manuscripts to rub their boots and scour their candlesticks.
Could you name any collectors from this period who tried to save these books from those sorts of fates?
So Robert Cotton would be one of the most important figures collecting in the early modern period. Hoping to rescue England's textual past, Cotton tried to save as many important documents as he could, and he ended up acquiring a large number of manuscripts now considered national treasures. Today, if you go to the Treasures Gallery in the British Library, you can see some of Cotton's manuscripts. He owned, for example, the unique copy of Beowulf, Sir Gawain and the Green Knight, the Lindisfarne Gospels, and two copies of the Magna Carta. Cotton was generous with his library, allowing scholars and literary figures access to his books, and even sometimes lending them out. In short, Cotton's library became an important and influential intellectual space in early modern London.
So Robert Cotton's library is now in the British Library in London, but what happened to it before that?
Unfortunately, the library became a concern during the reign of Charles I. Worried about the king's political enemies having access to Cotton's books, the government sealed off the library and Cotton never again regained his books. Years later, in 1731, a fire actually broke out where the books were being housed in London. Many of the manuscripts were damaged and some manuscripts were permanently lost. During the fire, in an attempt to save them, some of the books were even frantically thrown out of windows. And today you can still see damage from that fire on the Beowulf manuscripts.
So medieval manuscripts are simultaneously very durable and very fragile. And parchment, of course, lasts longer than paper. So many of the medieval books we're talking about were written on parchment rather than paper.
Yeah, so it is important not to forget how fragile books are as physical objects. Preservation has always been a major concern for collectors throughout the history of collecting. But it's also important to be aware that some collectors have massed controversial acquisitions under claims of preservation. Yes, I've just robbed a nation of a piece of its cultural heritage, but don't worry too much about that. Now this book will finally receive proper care.
So who are the most high-profile collectors in America in the early 20th century?
In the early 20th century, probably the two most famous collectors were J.P. Morgan and Henry Huntington. Today, their private libraries are important research institutions, the Morgan Library in New York and the Huntington Library in California. Aside from their collecting, both men, especially Morgan, were famous in their own right. Morgan was a famous banker and Huntington got his money from railroads. Both men were incredibly wealthy and they spent enormous amounts of money on books and art. Essentially, when they went on shopping sprees, they tended to make national headlines, sometimes international headlines as well. So if you were living in early 20th century America, there's a very good chance you would have been aware of their collections.
So these collections in the Morgan Library and the Huntington Library are one major source of evidence for their lives and collecting activities. But what other evidence do we have?
That's a great question. Morgan's earliest biographer said that Morgan was often painted as a demigod in one breath and a monster in the next, and the truth remains untold. And I think that statement could really be applied to both men. The contemporary accounts of their collecting are fascinating, but they are not always accurate. And a lot of these accounts offer somewhat amplified depictions of Morgan and Huntington, especially Morgan. You find accounts, for example, that talk about Morgan's intimidating physical appearance, that he smoked endless cigars, constantly played card games, that he spoke very little, ate little, or that he woke very early in the morning. In fact, you almost start expecting rhetoric of this kind by the people who knew him or knew of him. And there was a real hunger for information about him. Morgan lived this extraordinary life, and writers seemed eager to find clues about what made him unique. So suddenly Morgan becomes this massive figure whose eyes seemed to change color, who ate a lot of strawberries, and who had servants distributing breadcrumbs daily to sparrows. And these are all things actually written about him. But as you can imagine, at times the myth surrounding these collectors makes this kind of research challenging. Unfortunately for us, neither man left behind much in the way of personal materials relating to his collecting. We don't, for example, have personal letters or diaries explaining their own private thoughts on certain books or the real story behind particular purchases. So we sometimes have to get creative when we're piecing together the true story of their collecting. But in the end, it's worth it. Both men brought together really exceptional collections that continue to shape scholarship to this day.
Could you say a bit more about the kind of books they collected?
In terms of what they collected, broadly speaking, Morgan tended to acquire beautiful and rare items, and many of his books have an interesting provenance. For example, perhaps the book was once owned by a member of royalty or an important historical figure. And Huntington was drawn to monuments of English and American literature and history. In the case of Huntington, it's probably more accurate to say that he didn't just collect books, he collected entire libraries, and he ended up acquiring a large number of them.
How are these activities presented to the general public?
So the contemporary American press spent a lot of time praising American book collecting. We definitely see some nationalistic propaganda taking place here. For example, the New York Times called Morgan a genius at one point, and Huntington was declared the prince of collectors. The impression given by these contemporary press accounts is that collecting was a good thing for America and a sign of America's economic ascendancy. Why shouldn't American collectors own the most precious books in the world? They can afford to pay higher prices than anyone else, and they can afford to house these books in state-of-the-art libraries. Not only that, but we often encounter this argument that American scholars desperately needed a larger supply of research materials. In other words, scholars shouldn't have to travel to Europe every time they needed to consult a book. There was also the sense, and this comes up directly in a New York Times interview with Morgan's son, that manuscripts were safe in these collections. Some American collectors truly believed that books were not being properly looked after in European institutions. Once in America, these neglected books were finally going to get the appreciation and care they deserved. So these are the kinds of justifications for American collecting that comes up often in contemporary accounts. However, it was the expense of these books that attracted the most newspaper coverage. It was very well publicized how expensive these books were. That said, we do have to be careful with these figures, because they are not always accurate.
So how did the public respond to these high prices being paid for these old books?
Surprisingly, pricing is rarely discussed in a critical way. Instead, high prices are emphasized almost in an effort to justify the acquisition. In other words, a high price stands as proof that an item is valuable and is worth possessing. Cultural treasures don't tend to be associated with affordability. And these collectors were not shopping. They were not acquiring objects for the sake of acquiring them. They were depicted in many accounts as saviors of cultural heritage. They may be removing national treasures from the very places that made them, but they were ultimately saving them for scholarship in the public. So they were spending in new American ways and building new American libraries, but these collectors were part of that long, distinguished, aristocratic tradition of art collecting.
Were they criticized at all at the time?
Yes, they were. This may seem surprising because today we associate these collectors with their generosity, but we have to be careful about reading these figures backwards just because we happen to know how the story ends. During their lifetime, it wasn't always clear what was going to happen to their collections. And some critics not only questioned what Morgan and Huntington were doing, but asked whether they were the right people to be doing it. They weren't scholars. These were successful businessmen. Both men were accused at various points for buying what they did not understand, for buying too much, and for spending too much. But for every critic, there is also someone arguing that they actually spent wisely, that they were extremely knowledgeable, and that they applied business tactics to collecting in really clever and effective ways.
And thinking about those final intentions of Huntington and Morgan and the other libraries and collectors that Laura mentioned, these collections can be seen today in the Morgan Library and Museum on Madison Avenue in New York City, in the Huntington Library in San Marino, California, in the British Library next to St. Pancras Station in London, and several other libraries. And of course, you can also see many of these manuscripts online. So in the show notes, we'll be adding links to some of the highlights of these collections, so you can take a look there and see some of the books that have been talked about for yourselves. So we're coming to the end of this episode, but we're going to finish up with the question that we're asking all the guests in the podcast. Danielle, if you had the entire fortune of J.P. Morgan at your disposal and could own just one medieval manuscript, what would it be and why?
If I could own one manuscript, it would probably be a Bodleian manuscript known as Digby 133. It's an interesting manuscript for what it represents and who it belonged to. Digby 133 is an example of an important manuscript that doesn't look very important, so we're really lucky that it survived at all. The manuscript consists of different texts bound together, but mixed in are four English medieval plays. Three of the plays are unique copies, meaning that these are the only surviving copies left. So these are exceptionally rare texts. Unfortunately, the cheaper and more common and ephemeral a text is, the less likely it is to survive, and play texts generally fall into this category. But today, these texts are important to scholars because they offer a window into what that rich world of English drama was like prior to Shakespeare. But of course, the first owner of the manuscript would not have known any of that. The manuscript was first owned by Miles Bloomfield, a physician and alchemist living in 16th century England. He was also a practitioner of white magic, actually getting into legal trouble at one point over this. Bloomfield also had a book collection and seemed to be interested in plays. In addition to Digby 133, he possessed one of the earliest English printed plays and the very first play for which an author can be identified. It's actually the only surviving complete copy of this play, and today it's in the Huntington Library. Collecting plays was a pretty unusual thing to do in the 16th century. They weren't seen as particularly collectible, and they often weren't very attractive. The play texts in Digby 133, for example, are discolored and damaged from heavy use. But by somehow deciding to preserve these texts, modern scholars are indebted to Bloomfield and to collectors like him. Had this single book been lost, these plays would have been lost to us forever. So what this manuscript represents in a way is what collecting can do for scholarship.
That's such a great choice of manuscript. And can we see this one online as well?
You can, yes.
That's great. So yeah, it's in the Bodleian Library and we'll add that to the show notes as well. So that's all for this episode. Thanks so much to Laura and Danielle for sharing some of their work with us. And join us next time on The Cost of Culture.